Thank you for joining us for another podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California.
Good evening and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. I'm Jonathan Curiel and I'll be your moderator for today's program called Deteriorating Freedom of the Press in the Middle East. We also welcome our listening and internet audiences and invite everyone to visit us online at commonwealthclub.org. Deteriorating freedom in the Middle East is reflected in the number of journalists who have passed away there and been murdered. Last year in Iraq alone, 9 journalists were killed, a bunch in Syria, 2 in Yemen. This year's numbers are equally high. We have 2 distinguished speakers for today's discussion, Robert Rosenthal and Janine Zakaria, who have direct experience in the region and will put the issue in context. But before we talk to Robert and Janine, we're going to hear listen to a video and watch a video from the Committee to Protect Journalists. It's a well-known organization, and this video, also in words, will put the issue in some context.
In 2016, Turkey's government set a shameful record, the most journalists ever imprisoned by a nation in 1 year, with at least 81 reporters, editors, and producers in jail.
This is a crackdown unlike any before. This is the crackdown that would leave no actual working, surviving media left afterwards.
On the night of July 15th, a shocking attempt to oust President Recep Tayyip Erdogan was underway. By morning, it was clear that the attempted coup had failed. The government reasserted its control. Thousands of arrests were made in Turkey's military and civil sectors before the government turned its eye to the news media.
The government used this coup attempt as an excuse to eliminate all opposition on many fronts.
In the first couple of weeks after the coup attempt alone, we saw at least 100 media outlets shut down.
The arrests and repression of reporters have become routine since the July coup attempt. But journalists' troubles in Turkey began well before that. In March, Turkey's largest circulation newspaper was raided and seized by the government.
That was the moment that the government showed they have no scruples about entering a media outlet, taking it in a hostile manner, and then even arresting some of the top editors of that newspaper.
The government does not want any critical media existing in the country. What the government wants is an obedient media.
And before that, in 2015, a bitter attack on press freedom by the government landed respected columnist and editor John Dündar in prison after his newspaper, Cumhuriyet, published video appearing to show the Turkish military secretly moving arms across the Syrian border.
It angered Erdogan personally. Erdogan went on national television and lashed out against John Dündar and promised to never let him go.
O bu haberi özel haber olarak yapan kişi de öyle zannediyorum ki bunun bedelini ağır ödeyecek.
Dündar, who survived an assassination attempt in May 2016, eventually escaped the country and received CPJ's International Press Freedom Award for his reporting.
The case of John Dündar is emblematic of what has been happening to journalists and media outlets that have the audacity to explore sensitive subjects.
A free, democratic Turkey is being destroyed before the world's very eyes.
Sadly, the future looks bleak for Turkish journalism.
There isn't much of a press left in Turkey. The mood on the ground is that anybody can be arrested at any given time. Millions of people in Turkey are feeling like hostages in their own country.
Let us now hear from Robert Rosenthal. Robert is an award-winning journalist here and abroad. He has worked for some of the most respected papers in the country, including the New York Times, the Boston Globe, Philadelphia Inquirer, and where he was executive editor, and the San Francisco Chronicle, where he was managing editor. He joined the Center for Investigative Reporting as executive director in 2008. He has been an adjunct professor at Columbia University Graduate School of Journalism and the University of California Berkeley Graduate School of Journalism. Please welcome Robert Rosenthal.
Thank you, and thank you, Jonathan, and it's nice to be here at the new Commonwealth Club. So sadly, this is not a new story, the repression and squelching of journalists. It's not unique to the Middle East. You know, we can talk about a lot of places. Historically, when governments want to control their message and control their population, they control information. And, you know, we've seen that for many, many years as technology changed and evolved. It's changed. But, you know, Lenin famously said, this is not an exact quote, but, you know, why would he allow a man to have a printing press when a man with a printing press is more dangerous than a man with a rifle? The Nazis, you know, eliminated, among the first people they eliminated and really controlled were, in those days, the newspaper and newspapers for the most part. And they were able to commandeer mass media and control the radio, which was really the way information and propaganda were spread widely. And in fact, if you're familiar with Nazi Germany, the control of the radio was crucial because if Hitler gave a speech, everyone had to stop and stand at attention, no matter where you were. And if you didn't do that, you probably the Gestapo would come and get you. So the control of information is always crucial to despots, and the press, the best press, has historically, especially in this country, been adversarial. And if you go back to the history of the United States, actually the Alien and Sedition Acts in the 1790s were aimed at squelching the press, and because the press was really used as a tool by various political groups to get at the other side. And in those days, you know, a newspaper might be delivered weeks later. But one of the reasons the Founding Fathers understood that the information had to be distributed, if you remember, newspapers didn't have to pay any tax, so the mail system basically delivered newspapers free, which lasted for a long time. But this issue, to me personally as a journalist, and I started, as you heard, a long time ago at the New York Times, and one of the first things I worked on when I was an editorial assistant was the Pentagon Papers, which some of you remember. But I was 22 years old, and it really showed me personally what it was to stand up to power, the power of the press, and take risks. Even though I was a kid, I was part of the team that was taken off-site and put at the Hilton Hotel on 6th Avenue, New York, and I actually slept in the room with thousands of pages of top-secret documents. My job was to collate them, figure out what was what, and when someone needed something from something that was written about 1962 and what Kennedy was thinking, I had to find it. So that really, really infused my entire career. I did work in the Middle East. I was in Beirut in the 80s. We hear about journalists under threat. I was there when Terry Anderson, if you remember, was kidnapped and I think held hostage for nearly 5 years. I was almost kidnapped one day and the Lebanese army happened to come around the corner. I had a gun in my ear and guys yelling at me, "Do you speak English?" with my hands against the wall. So I think firsthand I've done that and understand the threat. I think right now, and I'm broadening the conversation a little, because I think what's happened in Turkey has happened historically again, and frequently the world watches and journalists object. But these steps taken to control information, control the media, if you want to call it that, control what newspapers do, because the challenge is the authority of people who don't believe there is any standard or any pillar or any reason to challenge authority, is to me one of the most dangerous things that really happen. The complications today of what we're seeing in Turkey, and really it's not simply the arrest, demonization, and killing of journalists. A woman journalist, I don't know her name even right now, was car bombed and killed today in Malta and assassinated. So journalists really take tremendous risks. In this country right now, there's a different tenor coming from the White House about what the media and what journalists are. fake news. We can talk a little bit about that. But this is an historic issue. It's not new. What's new, especially in this country, is the use and abuse of technology and the Pandora's box that's been opened to allow information to get around. So there's not only the positive side of what technology has done in terms of the free flow of information, there's really a very dangerous side about the manipulation of information and disinformation, because it's just accelerated something that's always existed. So as Jonathan alluded to, journalists take risk. Just to help frame the conversation, and it can go in many directions tonight, I always say that, you know, there are few professions besides the military and law enforcement where people are actually targeted and eliminated or put in jail or threatened as much as journalists. And we are pilloried a lot, and journalists do make mistakes, and journalists have biases. But from my point of view, it's a crucial part of not only spreading information and hopefully accurate information, but also holding power accountable. And power frequently does not want to be held accountable. So we can talk about all of these things. Part of the focus, again, is censorship. In my experience, censorship has always existed in some form in the Middle East, especially in a lot of the countries we're talking about tonight, certainly Saudi Arabia, Qatar. The Israelis have a different form of censorship. When I was a foreign correspondent in Beirut in the 80s, and you had to file in those days, if you can imagine, there was no internet. And you might have a telex, but a telex wouldn't work if there was no electricity, and a phone line might be kept open. But I knew any time I used a phone in Israel, there would be a censor on the phone. And he'd listen, and they'd literally cut off your line. You'd be dictating your story. Someone would be sitting, in my case, in Philadelphia, and typing as I read my story. I filed, I don't know how many hundreds of stories from Israel, and never had a story censored. And I wrote highly critical stories. What they would stop you from doing, and this is a different, is if you said, we're going to say, you know, I've learned, you know, Philadelphia Inquirer's learned that the Israelis are going to attack this neighborhood in Beirut tomorrow. They're going to go on this mission. They didn't want military activity reported. But in their case, the critical stories could be published. You would take abuse from the government press office the next day, but they allowed you to file. There's other kinds of censorship where you can't even get a story out of a country, and you can't get into a country, and they don't let journalists in. So we can also talk about that. I think one of the things, when you talk about censorship right now, there's a very powerful form of censorship going on right now, and it may be legitimate for security reasons, but the American military is highly engaged in various parts of the world right now, and you almost see no reporting on what they're doing. And the only time you really see any reporting is if, sadly, American troops are killed, because then they really can't keep it in the bag because the families find out. So there's a wide-ranging subject tonight. I mean, Janine has been in the Middle East more frequently than I have, and I'm looking forward to this conversation. But I do think it needs to be framed that this is not something new, and it's really important, I think, for people, whatever your politics are, and especially in this country, to really support the free flow of information.
Thank you, Robert. I want to reintroduce Janine Zakaria. Janine is the Carlos Kelly McClatchy Lecturer in the Department of Communication at Stanford University. Before coming to Stanford, Janine reported on Israel, the Middle East, and U.S. foreign policy for close to two decades, including stints as Jerusalem Bureau Chief for The Washington Post, Chief Diplomatic Correspondent for Bloomberg News, Washington Bureau Chief for The Jerusalem Post, and Jerusalem Correspondent for Reuters. She continues to write on Israel, the Middle East, the intersection of national security and technology, and media trends for the San Francisco Chronicle and other outlets. Please welcome Janine Zakaria.
Thanks. Thanks, Jonathan. Thanks, Robert. I want to start by a little bit of a chronology in terms of how I think we got from where we were when I started in the 90s to where we are today, and maybe push back a little bit on some of the point that Robert made about how nothing's really that new here. So when I started in the mid-90s and in Jerusalem, we used to put masking tape on the car that said TV whenever we were driving through the West Bank to identify ourselves as journalists. And I'm not sure that that would be, and that was a technique I think used. Were you guys doing that in the 80s in Beirut? So it was a pretty common technique because obviously you felt that it gave you sort of extra security. And probably now they wouldn't do that if you're going around in a lot of places, anywhere from Pakistan, certainly not Turkey, and in the West Bank, I probably not either. Jump ahead to 9/11, and suddenly now you've got a war in Afghanistan. You've got American and British journalists running all over the place, and the military didn't like this because it was obstructing how they could target because they had all these crazy journalists running around. So then they started embedding journalists in 2003. I was one of the journalists who was embedded in 2003 during the Iraq War. But you felt a cloak of safety if you were in embed, right? So there really wasn't much risk there. Now, in 2002, as a result of 9/11, you had Daniel Pearl, Stanford alum Daniel Pearl, who was beheaded in Pakistan. And at the time, that was, I mean, of course, enormously shocking. And it was it felt for a long time kind of like, in all its horror, as sort of an aberration. Terry Anderson was held hostage for 5 years. They beheaded Daniel Pearl. Now, skipping ahead, say, to another, now if we're staying in the Middle East, it's now August 2006, and the Lebanon War, Israel-Hezbollah War starting. And I can remember driving to the border. Now I'm with Bloomberg, and I'm driving to the Lebanon border. This is my mom, so I never really wanted to tell her. I would tell her I was going north. But now I didn't tell her exactly. And you could hear the warning sirens. You get messages, you know, take cover. So if I was going to get killed, it was going to be inadvertently by a Hezbollah rocket. And you feel kind of, I don't know, I wasn't nervous at that time. Call me crazy. Now, in 2007, when I was in Pakistan, I went back with Benazir Bhutto. Most of you, if you're coming to this audience, you'll remember Benazir Bhutto. She had been living in exile. And I had met her in an interview, and I said, I'd love to go back with you if you ever go back to run and be careful what you wish for anyway. So I ended up on the plane with her. And really, it was one of the scariest moments of my life, being on the back of a flatbed truck. Luckily, I was with Steve Cole, who writes for The New Yorker, and he's formerly of Columbia School of Journalism. And it was sort of just an instinct thing as a foreign correspondent. We got to get out of here. And sure enough, there was a big bombing on that motorcade and 132 people died. She wasn't killed that day, but she was killed 2 months later. So it felt like something in my life was changing. Now, skip ahead to 2010 when I'm reporting in Turkey, and I get sent to cover this kind of obscure, what felt to me at the time, Marcus Broccoli was the editor of the Washington Post, and he said, send Janine to go cover this $4 billion tax case against the Dogon Media Holding Group. And I said, why is he sending me to do this? Turns out it was certainly very prescient. When I went back to look at the piece today from 2010, so 7 years ago, the headline was, As Turkey Looks to the West, Trial Highlights Lagging Press Freedom. And it was all about Erdogan's crackdown on the media there. And I framed it as a bellwether of whether Turkey was actually going to be more democratic or was it going to turn autocratic. So now we have the results. Because at that time in the piece, they were 60 people in jail. And now they've got close to 200, depending on journalists. So things have definitely gotten worse in Turkey. And I'm sure we'll circle back to that. Now, in 2011, when you had the Arab Spring start, I was in Cairo in January 2011. And this is when for me at least, Robert, felt like things were different because it was the first moment in my career that I really couldn't do my job. I also happened to be pregnant, and so it was a whole different thing, separate story. But American journalists were being attacked, most famously Laura Logan, who was raped in Tahrir Square. And this was like, I had been to Cairo a million times. Just a few months earlier, I had shot video of a protest. Maybe it was a precursor to what was happening there. And now when I talk to my friends who are reporting from Cairo, they can't shoot a video or pull out a mic in the streets of Cairo. So in terms of being able to operate freely, there's definitely been a shift, at least since then. And then you see the journalists starting to get killed more regularly. And February 2012, the worst week ever for foreign correspondents in the Middle East, when you had Anthony Shadid die, one of the greatest Middle East reporters of our generation. He died of an asthma attack while he was leaving Syria secretly, because he couldn't get a visa. And then you had Marie Colvin in February 2012. You may remember her pictures of her. She had an eye patch. She had lost an eye in Sri Lanka, who was targeted, it's widely believed, by the Assad regime with a barrel bomb, and her family's now suing the Assad regime. And it just gets worse and worse as you go over through the last few years. 2013, in Egypt, they arrest reporters from Al Jazeera, including an Australian and a Canadian national. And by 2014, you have American freelance journalists being beheaded by ISIS. So to me, the trajectory is it's gotten much, much worse. And of course, you had Jason Rezaian after that, a local Marin native, American-Iranian, who was held for 15 months in Iran. So anywhere you look in the Middle East, it was pretty bad. Now, if you look at Freedom House, which tracks these things, too, they say it's also gotten worse, too, because global press freedom declined to its lowest point in 13 years last year. Only 13% of the world's population enjoys a free press. To me, that sounded like I was stunned by that number, and I actually tracked these things. And so I applaud Celia for putting this on, especially at a moment that Robert referenced where, I'll put it this way, I think there's an underappreciation for the kind of risks that journalists are taking, both American and, of course, local journalists in these countries, to report this news and to report in a critical way, on especially in authoritarian regimes. An underappreciation for the importance that credible, fact-based media play in these societies. So I do think, one, that it's always been dangerous, obviously, but I feel, and we could debate this a little bit maybe, that you're now more of a target if you're a reporter. Then it was always dangerous, but I think it's gotten worse. Second point is, and then however bad it is for us, the international reporters, it's 1,000 times worse for the local journalists in these countries. Just look at the numbers from CPJ and others. I made reference to that thing about how you have to change now how you report in some of these places, be a little bit more discreet about it. And then fourth, some of the places are just way too dangerous to go. So as Robert said, we have underreported stories all over the globe, primarily our war against ISIS, because we can't get a person into Syria right now. I mean, it's impossible. So, and then I'd say lastly, I mean, just to put a finer point on it, maybe, you can't be a foreign correspondent in the Middle East now without going to get hostile environment training. Like, I never did it. I spent my whole career, and I never did the thing where they kidnap you. My friends who are the top editors at these places now, they send everybody. And not only hostile environment training, and not only proof of life document that you have to fill out with questions that only my mother would know the answer to. You need to have a lawyer on the ground if you're the New York Times or Washington Post or NPR, who will be able to negotiate your reporter's release if they're taken.
Thank you, Janine, and thank you, Robert, again for your thoughtful comments on that. We have a lot of questions from the audience, but we also have a few questions from me. One of the questions I have is, you mentioned the Committee to Protect Journalists, a longtime organization. There's an organization called Reporters Without Borders, and both organizations do a really good job of spotlighting individually all these countries and doing it in a way that really gets into the nitty-gritty of these issues with each country. And so if you go to their websites, you see, you know, firsthand detailed analysis of the crackdown on the media. And the crackdown, in a sense, also, is reflected, as I said in the beginning, about journalist deaths, but also imprisonment and shutdown of media. And yet, I don't know if this issue is getting a lot of attention. I mean, I wonder if you could just talk about how much attention it's getting. And for example, in Turkey, they're curtailing, independent reporting. But where's the outrage, you know, say in Europe or even the United States? Is this itself an underreported issue?
Look, I teach a foreign correspondence class now at Stanford, and the challenge for the students is they have to tell an underreported story from abroad and make it go viral among their millennial peers, because I care desperately about all of us, but especially 20-somethings, knowing about these issues. And we had one student who actually tried to tackle the Turkey story, but I think that. This will be on the minds of Europeans more than it will be of Americans, simply because of Turkey's efforts to get into the EU. I think this will be part of a deal breaker for that, so they'll pay attention. But unfortunately, and maybe I'll just, we're halfway into it, let's just say it, when you have an American president who is railing against the free press, who is saying things, who is trying to throw things out there like taking away licenses that you can't even take away, or we really should toughen the libel laws, or criticizing journalists who report critically about him, that sends a direct signal to people around the world, autocrats around the world, to say there will be no consequences if they arrest journalists. So I actually think that his rhetoric is making it more dangerous and more for reporters to operate abroad.
Yeah, I think that the general public in America doesn't really pay attention. I mean, a Wall Street Journal reporter last week was charged and convicted of terrorism in Turkey. She wasn't there, but sentenced to prison as a terrorist for articles she wrote. So That's language when you call someone a terrorist. So I do think the press, you know, if you look at the polls, is not that trusted. And obviously, as I said, you know, it's not new what the president is doing in terms of criticizing the media, but it's ratcheted up to a level that is unprecedented. I met last week with journalists from around the world at International Press Institute, and one of the things they said they're seeing is around the world more aggressive restrictions on the press, and they think it's in part because the signals coming from the United States are what they are. And, you know, we just pulled out of UNESCO. I mean, we hadn't been involved really paying our dues for 6 years, but one of the mandates of UNESCO is supporting the free flow of information and press around the world. So a lot of people are very concerned about that as well. So again, I think it's a central issue, and it just plays into a narrative. And I think Janine's comments were fantastic, and I do agree that it's gotten more dangerous. I was referencing more the sense of trying to stop the press. But for individual journalists, I think it is more dangerous. And one of the reasons it's also more dangerous, I think, is because as part of the collapse of legacy media in this country, there are fewer foreign correspondents who actually have that tether to a big news organization. So when you're a freelancer, you're really out there on your own. You don't have all the support. You might not get the training Janine referred to, just the connection to a big organization that can raise hell if you are captured or taken prisoner or harassed. So that's another reason there are so many fewer foreign correspondents who are reporting back for the American public than there were even 10 or 15 years ago, certainly 25 years ago.
Let me just give you one stat on that, because I hosted an event in May on this. In 1991, the LA Times, I think, had 26. It was in the mid-20s, full-time foreign correspondents. Anybody want to guess how many they have today? Well, they have 6, but that was already in May, so there may be less. But along with that, there's no supplementing going on with freelance journalists, because people, especially in these danger zones, because editors don't want to assume the liability. So you can't even fill the gap with, even if you say, oh, it's the disruption to the news industry, there's no money to staff a big bureau, they're not even really taking freelance work, which means we're all underinformed in that respect, if you're still trying to rely on your newspapers for your news about the world.
I'd like to remind our listening audiences that this is a Commonwealth Club program called Deteriorating Freedom of the Press in the Middle East. We're talking with Janine Zakaria and Robert Rosenthal. We have questions from the audience. One of them has to do with Al Jazeera. And, you know, we've talked so far about the media and, you know, how reporters are affected. But here, let's remind people that Saudi Arabia and other countries, including the United Arab Emirates, have basically told Qatar to shut down Al Jazeera. There's an impasse right now in Israel. They're also threatening to close the Al Jazeera, essentially. Can you talk about the way that, in a sense, the media lends itself to bigger issues like diplomatic fallout? And it's not just the media. It's actually countries, if not at war, something a little less than that.
I mean, look, this Al Jazeera thing's been going on since they were born. And they really rattle the Saudis in particular. I don't believe they've banned them yet, right?
Right.
I think that they are too big a player to dismiss. And even if they, I mean, what would that even mean? I mean, they would still be available. People will find a way, right? We could talk about the way that autocrats are banning YouTube or banning Al Jazeera or banning whatever. People find workarounds for these things generally. So I think that, you know, they present a challenge, and there are things we could discuss about Al Jazeera's reporting and how they go about it. But it's part of what Robert said about how, you know, this is a long time issue of since going. How far back did you go? I mean, you know, very far back. So they want to be able to control the message. So it's not only Al Jazeera; it's everything. It's social media. It's anything that shines a light on what's happening in these countries. They're going to push back.
Al Jazeera is also a complication there, obviously, because who funds it? The government of Qatar. So
right.
And you have English and Arabic. And I know I'm not an Arabic speaker or reader, but there is different coverage. So it really, when the government controls and funds a news organization and you have that political and diplomatic turmoil in the Gulf, it lends itself to that kind of criticism. And Al Jazeera certainly was a lightning rod when it was created in the 90s and you know, but it is complicated, I think, by the funding, and obviously ties into the whole regional issues.
You are listening to the Commonwealth Club of California. Listen to thousands of our podcasts on iTunes or Google Play. And when you're in the Bay Area, please join us live for one of our 450 programs each year. You can find us online at commonwealthclub.org. And now, back to our program.
And that question reflects television coverage of the Middle East and not print reporting. But I think both of you will probably agree with this, that print reporting, certainly in this country, drives TV coverage, right? So you're talking about the lack of foreign correspondence. In a sense, TV is also reflective of that, correct or no?
Yeah, I think it is. It's you know, again, I was in the Middle East and Africa when there were a lot of journalists in the 80s. But, you know, the thing about television, it needs images. It gets to the story. And I think the deeper kind of reporting, I would call investigative reporting, tends to drive more coverage, I would say, on television than international. But they need what they used to call the boom boom. You know, they want to get the violence. They want to get action. And they always can't get there. I also can tell you that I've been in situations where things were relatively quiet. In South Africa, I was there before, when apartheid ended, and you'd have a big group of people. But sometimes when television cameras showed up and the lights went on, and the crowd would start going crazy to almost perform, and a riot would just explode. So there was always this interesting dynamic where I was a print guy just sort of wandering around. I sort of stood out because I'm white, and I might be the only white person in a crowd of thousands, but it was just a very different dynamic. A TV crew would show up, boom, people would come around it. And I've seen that over a long time during my career in terms of crowd reaction. But I think they're different media, but you're right. I think frequently stories are generated from print still.
Just to add to that, when I was researching my class, I can't remember if it was ABC or CBS News clip about that Benazir Bhutto bombing in October 2007 that I had gotten away from, but I wanted to see how they reported it. They devoted 7 minutes to it. That is an eternity in network news coverage. I couldn't even believe it. They had a map, and they were talking about Pakistan and giving you the history and the context and why you should care, and it was all there. Tell me the last time you put on network news or cable news and saw a seven-minute package about Pakistan, right? I mean, so I think we have to... And it's stunning. I mean, I get very flustered on this point, but I think if you know what you're getting, if you understand that cable news is talk radio on TV, that this is not actually a news source if you want to know about the world, and you look elsewhere and you say, okay, I'm going to watch the BBC, I'm going to watch CNN International, I'm going to read. I mean, in this great irony, and this applies beyond this topic, we have unprecedented access to information. But we live in this incredible era of noise where we're like, oh, do I look over here? What's this? Oh, let me see, you know? So you can find international news. It's just the things that the people are mostly watching in this country, they're not getting it there. And I think that's a terrible, terrible problem.
Janine, you talked earlier about Daniel Pearl and also Marie Colvin.
Yeah.
And those two represent indeed watershed moments in the history of journalism. Daniel Pearl was beheaded in Pakistan, and Marie Colvin, though, was targeted, seems, by the Syrian government. And that seems like a very pernicious case, because she was targeted by the Syrian, it seems, targeted by the Syrian government. She's not the only one who died. There was a photographer, a French photographer,
yes,
who died
that's
same
Thank
day.
Thank you for adding that.
And there was also a gentleman, a journalist, who was also badly injured. But it's the first time that I remember reading that there was the government targeting a journalist in that way.
Mm-hmm.
Can you talk, maybe expand about a little bit about why that is so horrendous in this unfolding history of danger that journalists face?
You know, I mean, maybe it's, I mean, Robert probably have a lot to say on this too, but I mean, I always, when I would travel to these places, I just never had to worry I never felt, maybe it was naive, that the government was going to kill me, right? Like maybe I'd get killed in one of those other ways. Accidentally by a rocket, by a bomb. Maybe I could get kidnapped by a terrorist group or these kinds of things. But so then who's going to protect you? And now it's happening everywhere. I mean, like we just had this Malta case today. Go home and read about it. Or in Russia, 58 journalists killed. I mean, Russia's like, and we know what President Trump said. Do you remember this in February when Bill O'Reilly said, you know, but Trump, you know, but he's a killer. And what did he say? He said, there are a lot of killers. You think our country's so innocent? So when, and there were, you know, and I mean, this is happening in Mexico. It's not, Mexico's probably the, maybe the most dangerous place besides Syria right now to be a journalist. I don't know if they're not complicit, then they're at least not doing enough to protect journalists, right, in some of these things. So I do think it's, I do think it's, the Syria situation is, yeah, it's, you're right to point that out, Jonathan.
Well, I just add, I think the only thing that really sometimes keeps anybody alive in a situation of conflict and chaos is accountability. Mm-hmm. And if, you know, in the case of Marie Colvin, they're allegations that she was targeted by the highest levels of the Syrian government. It was a missile. It wasn't a barrel bomb.
Yeah.
They actually
targeted
with a missile. Mm-hmm. So accountability. I was a prisoner in Uganda, and I'm lucky I'm alive. When I the army basically picked me up, and I think the government ordered it, and they were doing a rampage killing, similar to what happened in Rwanda later. But the only thing that I learned later that kept me alive was accountability, because somebody left a note in a gate at the American embassy and said, I've been arrested and beaten. And I have no idea who that person was because I was 30 kilometers north. But I realized later that somebody said, do you have this guy? And then they know, so don't kill him. So I think that's really important. And when the head of state has no accountability, or there's a belief there's no accountability, journalists are even more and more vulnerable, especially if the state, in a sense, is behind the attacks on the journalists and everybody knows it. They're not safe.
Yeah, thank you. And I just want to remind people, according to statistics that I saw today, 10 Mexican journalists were killed last year and 11 so far this year. It is pretty much the most dangerous place to be a journalist. We often don't hear the stories from Mexico because for whatever reason, deaths elsewhere are very important. But let's not minimize this. And thank you for pointing out the deaths that are happening essentially in our own backyard. One question from the audience, I think this is a really good question. Has the internet made it easier or more difficult for journalists to report stories? Technically, it may be easier, but what about the risk of stories being hacked and substantially changed, or journalists running a greater risk of being exposed in an authoritarian society?
I'll jump in on that. I think the internet is a diabolical tool for reporting, because the best reporting is you go to the story. And if you use the internet, you don't know what the hell you're getting. So I think it's as a research tool, and maybe you can get data, but, you know, I'm old school, I guess. But if you go to the story, you'll find out much more than you ever can imagine. And in the old days, the telephone was used that way. There were some reporters who wouldn't want to leave the newsroom, and they'd be on the phone, which is fine. But I can tell you, I was the editor of the Philadelphia Inquirer. Heard that. I remember one time a reporter said he'd used the phone. I took his chair, I wheeled him, it had wheels, and I pushed him into the elevator. I said, you get out of here. So that's what I could do. But I believe in going to the story. I think the internet is not simply a receiver of information. Obviously, it's changed the whole concept of publishing. The biggest and most influential publisher in the world is our president, and he uses Twitter. So the internet as a research tool for getting a lot of stuff is great, but it doesn't substitute for getting out to wherever something's happening. And that's the big issue with international reporting. We do not have eyes and ears out as a country like we used to. And you think about the horror that happened in Mogadishu this weekend. Imagine if that had been a European capital. Different story. So these are all things I think, you know, people who care, you can use the internet to research and get information from all over, but I think you really have to work on multiple sources. But as a reporting tool, I don't believe in it in terms of the field. There are different aspects of it that you can use, but we don't have to get into all that.
Just a quick add on that. I mean, what is the job of the foreign correspondent or international reporter, really? You're going there to bear witness, so to reinforce what Robert's saying. You got to bear witness, and you have to bring it back. And so it's hard to do it via the internet. And you have to provide that context for people, and it's the best way is to go. Now, in terms of the risks, though, reporters are communicating on things that on Signal and other kinds, using other technologies that can't be hacked. I just saw Hillary Clinton. She was speaking at Stanford last week, and she was recalling when she was Secretary of State how they developed – this was more for human rights activists, but I wondered if journalists actually have it too. They were trying to develop an app so that if you're about to be arrested, that you could press a button on your phone and it would delete all your contacts because, like, you know, and I was like, wow, that's really actually a good solution. I mean, this person's still getting arrested, but at least you don't have to worry about your 20 journalists. It would work for journalists as well. So I think there are risks. And I mean, just, it's such a cesspool right now on Twitter if you're a reporter. I mean, the harassment and the threats, I mean, not only for journalists, but especially for people who are reporting on some of these issues, it's not a fun place to be.
I just want to add one thought, because you mentioned sources.
Yeah.
You know, also as a foreign correspondent or working in this country, in my experience, I'm sure Janine's and Jonathan's, some of the most courageous people you meet are people willing to tell you what's going on, because they live in that country, and they're taking huge risks frequently just even meeting with you.
Absolutely.
And all of us have worked with local journalists who have helped us, who are also taking that risk. So they're really, journalism's a funny, you know, nobody gets into journalism to get rich. They're passionate, creative people who try and make a difference, and there's a real camaraderie around that globally.
We are living in the United States with a president who is, during the campaign, made fun of journalists and was encouraging others, essentially, and now that he's in office, is definitely still encouraging it. We have lots of questions about that, about Trump, President Trump. One question is, well, when Trump talks about the fake news and attacks on NBC, you know, from NBC and CNN, does that portend future censorship? And how bad do you think the repression could be? I know this is slightly off topic, but you know, I think both of you have alluded to Trump.
It's obviously a tactic. I think it's being done for lots of different reasons. Obviously, anything critical of him is not something he terms accurate. But at the same time, it sets up the potential for anything down the road that comes out that can be really harmful to his presidency. It's established the fact that you can't believe it. And we really have an information divide in this country, which is really dangerous. We could spend hours talking about that, what people tend to believe or not believe. And there's a phrase I read today, which I really, it's called confirmation bias. People go to information sources that confirms what they believe rather than looking in another way. One interesting sidelight today that was, I found really interesting, just driving in, I think, there was a report in the Washington Post in 60 Minutes yesterday about influence on the DEA and the opioid epidemic and the ability of the big drug companies to send out hundreds of thousands of pills without really any oversight. Well, interestingly, Trump was asked that about today, and he said, I have to study the report in the Washington Post. And he was asked, would he still support the guy to run the DEA who's fingered in that story? So he didn't call that fake news. He said, I have to study this report. There are serious allegations in it. I was astonished. And to me, what that signals is there's something about this guy doesn't like, he's going to deep six him.
Yeah.
But so there's a dichotomy here, there's an oddness to the whole thing that really plays to whatever the moment is and what also he thinks suits his goals, whatever they are. And frequently his goals are about himself.
So for me, I'm chilled. I'm physically chilled right now in this room also. I'm shaking, but I'm chilled. I get a chilling feeling anytime he says this stuff about I'm going to change the libel laws or, you know, all these threats, take the license. And I'm like, what country? Where are we? Is it 1940? I mean, what's going on? Who does this? American president. But I think a lot of that is his bluster and playing to his base and whatnot, but I think it's damaging, obviously. What I'm more concerned about is with the Trump question is, once the Trump era is over, or hopefully before that, how are we going to restore a respect for credible, fact-based reporting in this country? How are we going to educate people about what a real journalist is and what a not real journalist? You know, I need to teach my students not only to read the news, I need to teach them how to do it now, because there's such confusion. And when he throws out that term, fake news and whatever, and people are confused. And so we need to, but it's for the actual journalists also that I want to restore this. I don't want journalists to be as hated as they seem to be in this country right now. I mean, they're doing, set aside political journalism for a moment and just think about the reporters who went and reported on the fires this week, or the reporters who were reporting on Harvey. I mean, these are people that go into harm's way. You don't have to go all the way to Pakistan. You can doing it right here. The people who really, so nice what you said, however you described it. We're all here on this mission. And the president is making it seem like he called us the enemy of, what did he say?
Enemy of the people.
Enemy of the people. And for me, we need a collective response to this. There needs to be response from people in Congress. There needs to be response from the public. There needs to be response from journalist organizations and advocacy groups every time he says it.
You're here. We need leadership. And, you know, but there's always been a division, and it's just exacerbated now. And I have the same, I guess, reaction. I'm not sure the solution. I think the challenge is really this confirmation bias, which the audience has always had, and it's just accelerated and exacerbated, I think, by the technology.
Yeah.
And I think we're living in a period where the internet exploded 20 years ago, roughly. We have no idea, really, of the disruption. And historians will look back at this period and figure things out, not only in terms of the speed of information, you think about that, the speed and just the ability and the genius of the president has figured out how to completely dominate the information cycle through the technology and disrupt. He can disrupt anything any moment he wants to, and that's part of who he is. And he's figured that out. In ways past leaders have figured out how to use and manipulate the technology which then existed to control information. So it's a very dangerous moment, but I also think the audience. It's not just the media and the leaderships. It's an audience problem. And how do we as a nation address this divide where it's really hard for people to even talk about this? If we got into a political, maybe not in San Francisco as much. But think about that. How do you even communicate with people who disagree with you right now in politics? And how do you begin that conversation? And that's a big, big problem to try and follow. And there's a role of journalism in that as a facilitator of dialogue. And this is all stuff I think we all have to figure out.
I want to remind our listening audiences that this is a Commonwealth Club program called Deteriorating Freedom of the Press in the Middle East. We're speaking with Robert Rosendahl and Janine Zakaria. You've talked about Trump and people in the audience have talked about the kind of symbiotic relationship, in a sense, between Trump and dictators around the world, including Erdogan. We saw the Committee to Protect Journalists video where Erdogan essentially says about this giant scoop, you know, this person will be jailed and this paper will be stopped. That's something we don't see in this country yet, hopefully never. But I'm wondering if indeed you... you know, maybe you can elaborate on the idea that Trump has given a green light to leaders are in the Middle East, especially to crack down on journalists with impunity.
Based on what I've seen and read, I think that when the American president is critical of institutions that are sort of at the pillar of our society and democracy, and he criticizes them, the rest of the world pays attention. There's just no way you can get around that. And it's a pulpit that every American president has and uses or doesn't use. So I think it is risky, and it also incites other people who may share those feelings. It's okay. In other words, is there going to be accountability? Can you get away with something? So personally, yeah, I think it is dangerous. You know, the last journalist killed in this country because of his job happened here in Oakland. Some of you may remember Chauncey Bailey, who was assassinated in August of 2007. And I was involved in leading a group of journalists who worked on something called the Chauncey Bailey Project. And we got together really to try and find the killers and hold them accountable. And we did it. And the stories led to arrests, and some people are in jail now. But that's what journalists will do. We're not at that point in this country. The threat, though, in this country is much more from corporate pressure, from lawsuits. And that is a real threat, and that's why when the president talks about changing some of the libel laws and things, it really is a chilling effect. And obviously we have other things going on, the Gawker case. So these things are happening, and I think the public really has to understand the potential consequences because it affects everybody.
So when I covered the State Department for 5 years at Bloomberg, every year they would release their annual human rights report. I forget what it's called. I think it's the annual report on whatever the full title is. And I would go into the briefing room and we would all wait. And it was a very highly anticipated thing because our readers around the world were going to want to know what the U.S. was saying about them. And Condi Rice or Hillary Clinton or whatever come out and speak. Rex Tillerson did not do that. Okay, he didn't do it. I'm not even sure what happened. You know, I mean, the report eventually came out, I guess, but I think that sent a signal. Now, if you are circling back to our topic tonight, say you're a young guy like Mahmoud Abu Zaid, okay, who's an Egyptian freelance photojournalist. He used to send his stuff to Time Magazine and others. Helped us understand what's going on in Egypt. He's been in prison for 4 years, from age 26 to 30. Yeah, you could go, I know, to go on Twitter and look and see what's going on with him, but it's not like I'm expecting President Trump to bring up his case with President Sisi, right, when they meet. So he's not going to bring it up. Whereas I would have thought probably President Obama or somebody else might bring up a case like that, or, you know, why are you doing this? At least put some pressure on them. So I think it's indisputable that he's sending this kind of signal. Now, that doesn't mean that you don't have jailed journalists under President Obama. Don't misunderstand me. It has been, of course, these people have been detained. But this idea that we can have an impact, that people look to us for guidance on these issues. Is there going to be an accountability, or is there going to be pressure? You know, are we going to get a lower ranking? That used to be important, and I don't believe it's important right now with this president.
We have one question from the audience that actually pertains to this as a follow-up. What can people do to protect journalists and freedom of the press in the Middle East and elsewhere? Maybe it's being informed, more informed. Maybe it's contributing money to the Committee to Protect Journalists. Maybe it's something else. And any thoughts on that?
That's a good question.
I think they can do those things. I think that, you know, people, it's a time to be engaged in whatever you believe in. And I think whatever the issue that motivates you, that you care a lot about, or you believe in somebody doing the right thing, I think people should be engaged right now. Because everybody, you know, we're all sort of little atoms, but collectively, a lot of atoms can do a lot. And journalists are one piece of the puzzle right now. I think also, you know, get an online subscription if you believe in a news organization. Support them financially. I mean, there has been a collapse in this country of the business model, especially of newspapers over the last 20 years. It's true. I ran the Center for Investigative Reporting. We grew 10x in the time I was there, from, you know, 7 people to over 70. And a lot of people supported that kind of reporting. And we prided ourselves on being nonpartisan, whatever that means. But really, we were looking at power. So that kind of reporting does hold people accountable in institutions and truly can make a difference. And I could point to a long list of the impact of that kind of work. So there are things people can do to get involved and support the journalism they trust or believe in.
That's a good answer.
Let's get a little more personal here. Robert, let's start with you. One question from the audience is, in Beirut, when you were threatened and they asked, do you speak English? When you said yes, was that good or bad?
Oh, I didn't say anything.
Yeah.
I'll sort of set the scene. So the Beirut, 1983, 1984, civil war, you couldn't, if the electricity went out and the power went out every night, which it did, I was in an apartment that the Inquirer had, New York Times, Tom Friedman was in the same building, but the power would go out. And one night I had to file, and I walked to the Commodore Hotel where they had a big generator to file. And I had to walk back, and it was pitch black, and I was scared, like, bleep. And I picked up a stick thinking this is going to help me. And I'm in the middle of the road. I can't see anything. A car comes screaming around a corner in these little narrow sort of Parisian-like streets. And these two guys jump out, and one has a gun, and they shove me against the wall, and he says, do you speak English? Do you speak English? Do you speak English? And I just went, and about 100 yards away was the Saudi embassy, and the Lebanese army was guarding it, and they heard this car stop. And in Beirut at night, there weren't a lot of cars driving around, and they came running down the street because there were a lot of car bombs then, and these guys jumped in the car and split. And then I went, thank God these guys are here, and they just slammed me against the wall, and like, and they frisked me, and they found a paper that said Sahafi,
journalist
in Arabic. And this officer was right in my ear, and he goes, you are a fool. Go home.
Oh.
So that's what happened. I went home fast. But I filed my story.
Yeah, you always got to file.
Janine, do you have a story that you'd like to share with the listening audience and the audience here in the Commonwealth Club?
A story?
Yeah, a personal story, if not.
I have a lot of stories, but I don't know. Just along those lines, I'm thinking, it made me think of during the start of the Arab Spring, and one of the first things that Hosni Mubarak did was he cut off the internet. So the first thing you're thinking as a journalist really is not, am I going to stay alive? Is like, how am I going to file my story? So, or, you know, what's going to happen? And so I was also concerned about tear gas then. But I couldn't figure out what to do. I know what to do. But so suddenly the phone rang in my room. And like, hello? And it was my dad, Richard Zakaria, somehow got through. They'd cut all the phone lines and cut everything. Somehow my dad figured out how to call the Hilton and get through. And I said, Dad, you got to call the Washington Post. And we like put the phone, like, this first thing I said to him, and we literally dictated it through the line in New York. And it was like, so you have to be, what I teach my students, you got to be very nimble when you're a reporter. When one door closes, you got to go another way. But I mean, I've got a lot of other stories of reporting in the Middle East. And I guess I was lucky. I had a very good run while I was on the ground there. And I honestly, you know, this evening has sort of a negative tone, but I got to tell you, I really think it's the greatest job in the world, being a foreign correspondent and getting the privilege and the opportunity to go to these places and tell people's stories. I mean, I got paid to do that. So, and it was, you know, it is a great job. So not to leave it on a negative note.
Yeah, I agree. But I'm older than Janine, so you tell them the story about using a pigeon to file.
Thank you both of you for sharing those stories. We have a reminder from someone in the audience about the Freedom of Press ratings in 2016 by Reporters Without Borders, that Norway is the top country in the world for press freedom. Saudi Arabia is ranked 168th. Turkey is 155th. Qatar is 123rd, and the U.S. is 43rd.
It's not great.
Yeah, we're talking a lot about President Trump, but more journalists faced potential jail under the Obama administration than any prior president. So it's not simply a right-left issue. It's power and being really unhappy when you see stuff that's either critical or you don't want exposed. And it gets, these are deeply important questions in our society. So it's not, we happen to be talking in the moment, but this is, again, like I said earlier, really a historic issue.
And I also would, if you don't mind, would like to ask this. There was a report in the last couple of days, it might have even been today in the New York Times, about how Egypt is cracking down on gays in the country in a way that they've never done before. Mass jailings, threatening gays. And they're using social media to track down people. And also, people who are basically informers. And so the media have, you know, suffered crackdowns, but it's also other groups that are targeted, not just the media. I wonder if you could talk about that maybe and how there's a kind of relationship, in a sense, media and then others who are essentially marginalized and picked on by governments.
Well, I think that what's true is that small groups of people who are on the fringes, and this happens certainly in Chechnya a lot in the gay community there, are marginalized and targeted. I think journalists are more dangerous in a way because they have a voice. And I think it's a little different. And historically, some of the people who have defended or exposed the stories about what were happening to minority groups were the journalists. So maybe there's a symbiotic relationship there if you don't have a free press or people who are willing to tell those stories. But there's no question that, again, the technology is both a benefit and it's a tool for tremendous abuse. And I think we just have to really keep thinking about that and understanding how that can happen.
Yeah, I mean, look, this on this question of also kind of what is embedded in your question, Jonathan, is like the role that social media is playing. And on the one hand, it has facilitated a lot of, connections between different groups around the world and given voice and allowed people to organize. But it also poses a threat in the terms of being able to, for governments to use these social media accounts to monitor people and to go after them. So there is a risk there.
We probably have time for maybe one or two questions. Maybe this may be the last question. And this question is kind of a complaint, actually. The question is, why does the U.S. media conflate Middle East countries with their dictators? So there's this person says that there's a distinction between Putin and the Russians, but not between, say, the Saudi monarchy and the Saudi people. I don't know if you even agree with that question, but I wonder if you could talk about the role in the Middle East for journalists in terms of making distinctions rather than, say, conflating. Maybe you can even talk about your own experience or even a best.
Yeah. So for me, every story is about the people. So I don't care how bureaucratic or how, you know, I'm editing a story tonight about a creek in East Palo Alto and from a student of mine. I'm like, where are the people? Who's impacted by this? Show me some people, right? So but there were times you had to do the high-level diplomatic story. Saudi Arabia did this, that, and the other thing. But you always look for those kinds of stories, too. And I can remember being in Saudi Arabia and my editor sent me to Saudi Arabia after Egypt and Bahrain. He said, go to see if there's going to be a revolution in Saudi. I said, there's not going to be a revolution. He said, go there anyway. I said, all right. So I looked for stories and, you know, went and interviewed these people and wrote about the Saudis. And I found this progressive bookstore. And, you know, you can find these stories about the people. I actually had to write an op-ed a few years later because I had heralded it as maybe a sign that the Saudis were loosening up and then they shut it down. So I wrote kind of a corrective. But, you know, I think, I don't know, is there more distinction between, it's an interesting whether we, look, I think overall we're all underinformed on all of these places. And maybe not this crowd, of course, but in general as Americans. And so there's only so much 6 foreign correspondents for the LA Times compared to 28 could do. And there's only so much the media can do. And they, you're right that maybe sometimes they only do, you know, they'll maybe do one story on South Sudan in the New York Times this year or whatever. Or NPR went to Myanmar and did, that was a big push for them. And we'll see when they get back there again. We have nobody going to Yemen right now. The worst. What, I mean, children are dying there en masse. What was the last time you read a story about Yemen? Okay, reporters can't get visas. They can't get in. So we have all the stuff we need to know about. So I'm less concerned about that, but I appreciate the critique.
Well, I think I sort of agree very quickly. I think it's part of the challenge is that the lack of knowledge. Mm-hmm. People are parachuted in. They have no context. They have no history. And also the fact that they're not even allowed to be based in some of these countries. So it's complicated, but I think there's lots of different reasons. But, you know, there just aren't that many people out there. And we get very, I don't know what the breakdown is of international news if you go to the networks or cable shows, but it's minimal. And even the horror that's happening in East Asia with the Rohingya and what's going on there, there are some stories out of there, but that's a huge genocidal push. And we don't get numb, but it's the interest in this country historically to what's happening abroad is not a highlight. It's not something we're fixated on. We're very inward looking and probably more now than ever. Of course, we're looking at, you know, but you can't, when you think about North Korea, how isolated it is, Tehran, I think, is there one or two American correspondents in Tehran right now in the whole country? You know, they've let in some American journalists in North Korea, and those stories are definitely worth reading in the New Yorker, and who else got in recently? The Times?
Christoph got in. And his team.
They're letting people in. Mm-hmm. But we are, like, and imagine what the world looks like when you're inside North Korea, if you want to talk about isolation. But that's another night. Mm-hmm.
Thank you, Robert Rosenthal. Thank you, Janine Zakaria, for today's presentation. You've been listening to Deteriorating Freedom of the Press in the Middle East. We also want to thank our audiences here and those listening to the recording on the internet. I'm Jonathan Curiel, and now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, celebrating over 113 years of enlightened discussion, is adjourned.